already dead. Once Nox is on the job, it's over, baby. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, you're right. I'm
okay, welcome back, listener. It's been a fair old while since we jumped into a retro movie and cast our eyes upon it to let you know whether or not it's worth returning to. This time, we are going to take a trip down the road to Jasper, Missouri, and we're going to pop into BC's favorite roadside bar, the Double Deuce, because we both rewatched 1989's Roadhouse, naturally because this movie has improbably been remade or rebooted, whatever they do with films nowadays, with Jake Gyllenhaal and is it Conor McGregor and I'm sure various other UFC fighters. I am morbidly intrigued by the remake of Roadhouse and got it into my head that we should rewatch this. And I know how much BC loves returning to these late night cable classics. So I always enjoy trying to sum these these movies up. Roadhouse is the tale of Dalton, who is the best bouncer in the business. I'm just going to pause the summary to say I love the fact that in the 1980s, everyone in America knew who the best at every profession was. You know, like the best pilot, the best soldier, the best driver, the best teacher, the best milkman, you know,
the best arm wrestler.
The best arm wrestler. You just knew who the best was, and everyone knew. You know, you walk into any town in America and be like, who's the best bouncer? And they'd be like, it's Dalton. It's James Dalton. So his reputation precedes him pre-internet, and he's visited by a bar owner who apparently doesn't want to spend his money on just refurbishing his bar. He'd rather spend it on getting a really expensive $500 a night bouncer to come in, with medical expenses paid, and clean up this bar. So, you know, Dalton does the right thing. He quits his job, gives his junker car to a guy on the street who's not a valet, and takes his fancy New York plated Mercedes, drives it down to Jasper, Missouri, pulls up at the Double Deuce, realizes that the owner is right. It is a complete shithole. And people just seem to fight and break the tables every night. And he's tasked with cleaning the roadhouse up. And it becomes quickly apparent that the real issue with this place is the super wealthy Brad Wesley, who seemingly has become super wealthy just by running a kind of protection racket in the shops of this small town. I'm not sure who he's protecting them from. Like, I get it when it's the mafia in the big city, but when it's in a town like this, I don't understand how or why. But anyway, he incurs the wrath of Brad Wesley pretty quickly. And then it just turns into a kind of playground battle in this nightclub every night, which, you know, throw in a doctor who is charmed by Dalton's mixture of martial arts and philosophy, and you've got yourself what some people say is the greatest B-movie ever made. What do you think, BC?
It's where a to live begin? Action cartoon. Yeah, it's a live action cartoon. I mean, literally from the first couple of minutes of the movie, I was like, this is farcical. However, I did watch a video of bouncers giving their take on the movie, and it seems like almost everything in this movie almost is plausible depending on where you're at in the world or what year it is. However, you know, this is some, this movie is some kind of nexus for bouncers. This is some like on otherworldly stuff where law enforcement doesn't exist at all. Like it is, that's the, just the thing that kept running through my head. Where on earth would this, any of this stuff would be allowed to happen, where someone can just pick up the phone and call the FBI, you know, like, or someone to come in and stop the madness. But I think the ethos was make the best B movie as well as let's make a modern Western where clearly things like this could happen in small towns, you know, in a new frontier where there's a bit of lawlessness going on. But in what, 1989?
Yeah.
Could this still happen? Apparently so. This is a small pocket universe where everything is settled with violence. Nothing more, nothing less. And honestly, I feel like it's kind of interesting to watch Patrick Swayze's Dalton, who's a philosopher and a thinker, and in many ways tries to be the cooler who doesn't, you know, resort to violence, you know, unless he has to in his domain. But then this dude turns into a villain. Like, I mean, it is like, it reminds me of like this bizarro discourse that I am not really following, but like, you know, like Zack Snyder has this take where, you know, that having Batman murder people makes it more interesting or something to that effect. And then you have a very famous comic book writer, Grant Morrison, responding, and where he says like, well, if Batman's killing people, then he's no better than the villains.
Right.
And then like, and you got like everyone taking sides, and you know, I don't care enough to follow it, but then that's kind of what I thought watching this movie, where you're rooting for Dalton and then all of a sudden he snaps and loses his mind and then like rips out someone's trachea. Like it's really like you're watching
for the second time.
Oh, that's true as well. But like really, like you watch him keep his cool until he's not cool anymore and he just goes on his killing spree. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and not killing spree, I should say. Well, I mean, yeah, well, more or less just goes out and just like just hurts a bunch of people. Like, you know, with a vengeance.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's I guess it was a very popular plot of the time and it continued, you know, I mean, I guess maybe it started with Death Wish, but maybe it started earlier than that with you know, Westerns, you know, this idea of kicking a guy enough until he can justifiably go and kill everyone, right? And it's like it's satisfying our bloodlust. I mean, I watched it with my partner who'd never seen it, which is always a joy, because she's like reacting to Ben Gazzara, who plays the main villain, Brad Wesley, and Marshall Arteague, who plays the kind of head honcho or the head henchman, sorry, Jimmy. And she's like, oh man, they've got to, I really want to see them beat that guy up. Like she was just, she was so in it. And like, I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. This guy's a real asshole, you know, like, but the throat ripping out, I mean, like often when we do this kind of thing, you know, we'll talk about the first time we remember watching this movie. And I've got to be honest, I think this is one that I missed as a younger person. I think the first time I sat down and watched this movie, I feel like I was working in a Blockbuster and they were replacing all the video with DVD. So they were like bulk selling off the VHS and no one wanted them. And we got staff discount. So I was picking up VHS for like 20 or 30 pence, you know, which is, you know, like the equivalent of like 40 or 50 cents, like 25 years ago. So it was nothing. And I think I bought this and I stuck it on thinking, I feel like I should have seen this movie, but I don't think I've ever actually watched it. because Patrick Swayze I avoided for years because of Ghost and Dirty Dancing being two popular movies with girls when I was at school. So I assumed Patrick Swayze was like a kind of wishy-washy heartthrob. It wasn't until I watched like Point Break, you know, and maybe like Red Dawn and a few other movies that I was like, oh, okay, you know, maybe this guy can do some stuff. But yeah, the talk of the throat being ripped out was always a big thing. It was one of those like playground conversations, like, oh, have you seen this movie Roadhouse? You know, the guy gets his throat ripped out. And I'm pretty sure they always cut it out of the TV version. And I just remember thinking, like, there's no way he really rips a guy's throat out. And then I watched it and I was like, shit, he just ripped that guy's fucking throat out. Like, just like threw it on the ground. Like, okay. I just, even when it's first mentioned in the movie that he's done it to someone else, you kind of feel like, well, they're going to say he's done it. But it becomes like Chekhov's throat instead of Chekhov's gun. It's like, well, they said he ripped a guy's throat out. So now we have to see him rip a guy's throat out. I mean, Jesus, yeah, he really loses his philosophical cool at that point.
Well, yeah, that final fight is probably the only thing I remember. I'm seeing it as a kid, I'm sure, like on cable. I don't know how many times, but it wasn't something that really stuck with me. But just the ending, that fight, and also remembering that you don't really see the throat ripping clearly. Like, you don't really see him holding anything. You see a hole in the throat.
Yeah, there's none of that.
Yeah, you don't see, like, yeah. you don't see that the trachea and all its bloody glory. But that's all I recall is really just that that last fight.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's... there's certainly a lot to dig through here. The director Rowdy Harrington, he actually was crew in a lot of movies. I didn't actually know this, but he worked on Nightmare on Elm Street, which is my favorite movie of all time, just as like an electrician or something, or a gaffer. But he was in a few roles like that when he was younger. His directorial debut was a movie called Jack's Back, which I don't think I've ever actually watched, but it's James Spader as this kind of, I think he gets suspected of like copycat killing in the style of Jack the Ripper, but it's in like 1980s California or something. And I think it's like a dual role. Like he plays himself and like maybe his evil twin or something. He made this movie after that. He made Gladiator, but not the Gladiator that you're thinking of. The one with Cuba Gooding Jr. and the guy out of Twin Peaks, whose name I've forgotten. It's like a boxing movie. And then he made the probably, if not the worst, one of the worst Bruce Willis movies, Striking Distance, which is when Bruce Willis was in that career patch that maybe people forgot, where he kind of dropped out of favor in the 90s. And Pulp Fiction kind of pulled him back a bit, but like he had this run of like really awful movies, and this guy directed one of them. I would be willing to bet that this is definitely the most enjoyable of those movies. At a glance, it is ridiculous. It is a very thinly plotted Western with a guy coming into town and trying to clean things up. And instead of using guns, he uses martial arts, which I think was probably very in vogue at the time in this kind of fare. You know, you had Van Damme, you had Steven Seagal. Swayze was trained by the dashing Benny the Jet Erkadez, who you know, we were talking about Willem Dafoe in Poor Things in the previous episode. I think, you know, Benny the Jet faintly resembles Godwin Baxter. Although if he's still alive, I would not want him to hear me say that because he's a terrifying individual. My best memory of him is Gross Point Blank, the fight with John Cusack, which is absolutely great. But yeah, he trained everyone and he said Swayze could have been a kickboxer. You know, like he gave him high praise. So don't fuck with Swayze.
Yeah, you said Swayze was cat-like, and I think initially the training was a bit difficult until he put on music, and then they were off to the races.
He started doing a bit of dancing, and
he had. You know, what Swayze was, it with a ballet dancer?
Yeah. He dancing was his first love, I believe.
And a football player, right? So was he also a football player too? Because I think,
maybe.
You know, I think, I mean, as we'll get into it, like when making this movie, because there's, the initial cut of this movie was like 3 hours long, and there was a lot of fight scenes, and Benny the Jet really choreographed a lot of these. Some of the stuff was improvised, but it was thoroughly brutal on everyone who was acting in this movie. And because there were no stuntmen, all the actors did their own stunts. A number of these guys were hired because of their background, but Swayze wasn't one of them. And I think he had a knee injury that, like, I think was also a problem on Dirty Dancing. And it's especially so making this move. But I thought he was also a football player.
He probably was. I feel like that's a solid career path into Hollywood in this era. You know, like you can throw a dart and find a retired football player in Hollywood in the 1980s. I remember he, and now, yeah, that's true. Yeah, and they got Restless too. He had an interesting, almost like a dual career. Like, as I said earlier, like my first introduction to Swayze was very much heartthrob. Like, he was like the first crush that most of the girls in my school had, talking about Dirty Dancing, talking about Ghost. As a young boy, thus I was kind of completely repelled to this idea, and something about his name just had this kind of teen heartthrob ring to it as well, like Swayze. I don't know, it just sounds like a made up name somehow. Like, I don't know what his lineage is, but it's a very, I've never heard that name before or since. What is this lineage? Yeah, I don't know. Swayze, what is that? Like, I mean, it's got to be something, but yeah, but going back, like, I actually think Patrick Swayze is a really quite engaging leading man. Like, he's, you know, he's certainly not a character actor, but he does the job of leading man, or like, he's kind of played like a mentor role more than once. Like, I feel like in Point Break and in Red Dawn, he's like the older brother. Even in The Outsiders, I think he's kind of the older brother character. And that ice hockey movie, which is better than it has any right to be. I've completely forgotten the name of it. I don't know. It's a great ice hockey movie, actually. But he's good as the sort of slightly older guy with a bit of a history to him. He pulls it off. I feel like he just kind of, after Point Break, he just sort of disappeared. And of course, there's the irony that I think maybe the last film he made was Donnie Darko, right? Which was Jake Gyllenhaal's big break. So, you know, he kind of passed the mantle to young Jake Gyllenhaal to years later crop up in a remake.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Take the throne of Dalton the Cooler. I'm sure other people have made that connection, but he's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you talk about a 3 hour cut. I mean, we've got Sam Elliott, who I feel like is in this movie for about 10 minutes, but he's the second best bouncer in the world. And he's great. I mean, he plays Wade Garrett, which is about the most cowboy name I could possibly think of.
Well, speaking of cowboy names, everyone has a cowboy name.
Everyone has a cowboy name, right? Even the girls called Doc.
Yeah, Doc. Yeah. Everyone. Wade Garrett. Everyone has a Western name.
I feel like there's got to be more Sam Elliott in that 3 hour cut. There's an actress, I can't remember her name, but she plays the waitress who seems more important at the start of the film and then just kind of disappears. Like, she at one point in the film, she comes over to bring Patrick Swayze coffee. she's kind of, she seems like the sort of plucky, more charming member of staff at the Double Deuce. She sings a song at some point. But Carrie again, Ann. She, Carrie Ann, yeah, she doesn't, yeah. It doesn't really go anywhere, you know, which isn't to say that, I'm sure this cut is better than any potential 3-hour cut that's out there, but like there is a part of me that would love to sit through the director's cut of Roadhouse just to see, you know, 8 more fights choreographed by Benny the Jet. And, you know, there's someone of note who I think deserves to be resurrected, you know, who I was watching the credits and I haven't watched this film probably for about 10 years. Keith David's name pops up 5th on the credits or 6th on the credits. And I'm like, who the fuck is Keith David in Roadhouse? Like, I don't remember him being in that movie at all. And like, I would remember it's Keith David, you know, like the man is a legend. And I'm watching and I'm like, is Keith David going to be like a hired henchman or something at some point? Like, where's Keith David? And then I think about an hour in, Keith David like serves someone a drink. And I'm like, that's Keith David in Roadhouse, like with glasses on as well. Like, I think he plays Ernie, but I don't know if anyone actually calls him by that name. I had to like check the cast list. Like, what the hell happened to Keith David?
So his character comes into the bar with his girlfriend, and there were some racists there. And again, another fight. Ensues and where him and Dalton bond, and then I assume because they needed a new bartender since their first one or original one was scamming, right? And
yeah,
you know, yeah. Skimming stuff off the top. He offered Keith David a job there, and I think there was a whole, you know, there's a whole side story that involved like Ernie Bass and James Dalton, you know, bonding and, you know, and getting together. And I think with the 3-hour cut, the first thing that had to go was the black bartender. As I heard repeatedly on the extras for this movie, the black bartender had to go. So basically, wow. They just scooped out everything that was going on between those two characters. So I think it was basically fairly sizable like role and aspect to the movie. So I think they also took out you know other fights and probably there's a couple other things they removed, but the first thing that had to go was that everything that involved Keith David's character.
Isn't Bass, that's the name of like a famous lawman from the West, right? Like,
yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if that's intentional.
Probably. Like I think Bass... almost everyone, Bass Reeves.
Bass Reeves.
Yeah. So that's right.
That's interesting. I mean, it was definitely, I think, a trope of the time. The late 80s, the early 90s, where the white hero would kind of, you know, save a person of color and kind of take them under their wing. And like, you know, I mean, maybe like if his name was still pretty high up the credits, maybe Keith David got the best deal. Like, I'm sure he still got paid and didn't need to see that kind of worn out trope carted out again. Maybe that wouldn't have worked with the Sam Elliott dynamic as well, because he's kind of, or you know, the Swayze character has the love interest, he has the villain, he's kind of got like a semi sidekick character. I don't know, but it would be interesting to see, because Keith David is inevitably great in everything that he does. So
yeah, also I
it's
think,
just interesting.
But also, I think the Elliott character in what is his name, Garrett. So you had Garrett and Dalton. I think they were supposed to be war buddies who became bouncers.
Okay.
And then I think that's kind of, you know, I guess that's, you know, their backstory. But just, you know, just from the beginning of this movie, I just thought, you know, you got Swayze being like, what is this guy harassing women?
yeah,
you know, stabbing his money on the table and then slashing Dalton. He gets kicked out, and then Dalton doesn't do anything. I'm like, no law enforcement, no nothing. And then the guy still wants to fight him. Like, you know, he wants to challenge him. And it sounds like for most bouncers, like, you know, occasionally this happens. You get like challenged by customers. It sounds like a lot of bouncers are challenged by other bouncers. But yeah, I think it was just like from that point onwards, it's like, what is this? Like, it's just, this is so far removed from reality. And then, it just gets far more farcical as it goes on. But just looking at the fights, I mean, I agree. Like, I think Swayze is captivating in his series until, you know, he isn't. Like, you know, when he goes off the rails and everyone else is a bit, you know, like everyone's a bit cartoonish and everything's over the top, including the fights. But it's also mesmerizing to watch that amount of carnage that occurs like every night. I couldn't even imagine someone trying to have enough money again, which is real. You bring in like good bouncers to set up your security, establish things until you can't pay them enough or until, you know, you get a team in place and they go, you know, but like, you know, I couldn't imagine this bar owner having any money at all with everything being destroyed every night, people throwing like glass bottles at the band. And like, it was just, you know, it's utter anarchy. But you'd be sued into oblivion if you're a bar, you know, like a bouncer who kicks someone in the face or like, you know, like, or, you know, wrecks and destroys them. It's just, it's insane. But like, I think Swayze, you know, carries it, which is really funny. Like how stoic he is in the face of all this madness is really funny.
Right. No, totally. I mean, I think Kelly Lynch said, they all just played the thing totally straight, which there are a few things as entertaining as a ridiculous movie that's being taken very seriously and kind of follows through. And yeah, like, I mean, I have similar feelings with, I won't get diverted, but like a movie like Top Gun, you know, it's just, it's so damn serious and earnest and I kind of love it. It's like opera. It's so heightened and ridiculous, but actually a lot of thought still goes into it. There's some nice little touches. Like I, you know, it's nothing ingenious, but I like the fact that whenever he went to a new job, he bought himself like a shitty car to park outside because he knew that it would be getting like bricks put through the window every night. And, you know, he's got this great Mercedes, which, you know, at the time was a fancy car that he leaves in a lockup. And yeah, like there's a lot of nice little touches. It's a fantasy land. I mean, I read, as I often do with older films, I went back and read Roger Ebert's review, and he said, you know, this is a very engaging film, but this strange little town where it appears there's only like two residences and like a nightclub and like a Ford dealership, and it's just like, what's going on in this town? You know, I mean, like, where are all these people at night? Like, they're either at Brad Wesley's house, like skinny dipping and partying, or they're at the Double Deuce. And then you've just got like this old farmer that rents out his loft room. And I mean, it's all just so surreal. And I feel like the trigger point for Ben Gazzara's character really coming after Patrick Swayze is that he sort of had a crush on the Doctor too, and he sees them having sex quite flagrantly out on like the rooftop at night, you know, like, and she doesn't wear any underwear on the first date, by the way. And he's like, right, I gotta go after this guy.
But that's also why it's like, you know, Bill Murray's favorite sex scene of all time.
Oh my God. Yeah. I discovered the same thing. Right. So he phones up Mitch Glazer regularly, puts on a voice and says, Patrick Swayze just slammed your wife against the wall. It's, yeah. I mean, he's a whole other story, Bill Murray. But like, apparently, yeah, he loves this movie. No, I didn't even spot it. But my partner was like, she's not wearing any underwear. What kind of a doctor is this?
Yeah, but so you know, neither was the 19-year-old in the bar, you know, had that dress, right? That was her, right? Like, with yeah. the, you can see through it on the sides, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
I think that if I had to compare this to Top Gun, I probably like this better than Top Gun.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but at least with Top Gun, like the first half, and I just think like Tom Cruise's character is like a crazy person, you know, and all this testosterone. And again, just someone it's a character that I just doesn't gel with me at all.
Yeah.
But then after, was it Goose?
Mm-hmm.
After Goose dies, and then everything flips, and then, you know, he learns his lesson. There's his journey arc or what have you. And, you know, it's interesting where this is just, it was the opposite where, you know, I really like, you know, Swayze's, demeanor and just like what he was trying to impart and what he managed to do in spite of all the madness. And then he just snaps and loses his fucking mind.
And then everything
really comes apart in that town, right? Like, shops blowing up. You got like fucking monster trucks, you know, destroying like car dealerships, homes exploding, people being stabbed to death. And, you know, it's just like anarchy, you know, like mobs roaming around with, you know, vigilante justice coming for the bad guys. It's crazy.
It's utterly insane. It is. It's totally insane. But it's an interesting point you make, because I feel like there were a lot of these characters in the 1980s that really weren't very relatable at all. You know, these kind of unhinged, riding like right on the knife edge kind of characters that we, or at least audiences at the time, lapped up. And it was, you know, I mean, like Tom Cruise in Top Gun is literally called Maverick, you know, like, and of course he's the best, by the way. And
of course,
yeah, like it's almost like the message is like, I don't know, like if you're good at something, just it doesn't matter what gets in your way. Like even if it's killing people and like being completely insane, you always have to push it to the limit and beyond, no matter what. I mean, it's just one vein of particular storytelling in the 80s, but I do think these kinds of characters were popular. And in a way, like, you know, superhero movies weren't big at the time, but these characters are as amped up, if not more so than superheroes. They're probably less nuanced than superheroes, really. I mean, this film is, if it wasn't for the, you know, Nicholas doctors and tracheas being ripped out, you probably could watch this movie with your kids, and it's has the mentality of a, you know, a kind of a playground bully and the guy that comes to dole out justice.
Yeah, my kids didn't have a chance to, you know, watch some of the good old 80s fare of like, you know, scantily clad, half naked girls running around for no good reason, or 19-year-olds like stripping in bars, and it's all good. And even with the I guess the law enforcement does eventually arrive, and then I can see why you wouldn't need them when, like, you know, the murderers are caught red-handed, and they said, "Oh, what's going on?"
I didn't see anything.
It's like,
I think maybe the cops were cut out. Maybe, you know.
Yeah, they were on the cutting room floor.
Maybe the main cop was played by Tony Todd, and they were like, "We're all right. We got rid of the black bartender. Now we're getting rid of the black cop. Come on, this is done. You know. I don't know. Like, we actually briefly talked before this, but I did read that the screenwriter, I think he's called R. Lance Hill, which, again, those people that can just put a single initial at the start of their name, I've got a lot of respect for that. But I think he found the story of like some small town somewhere like in the middle of America where a similar character to Brad Wesley was murdered out in the main street by a bunch of business owners. And then when the cops came along, they just said, "Yeah, we didn't see anything," you know. And I'm sure they weren't holding smoking guns at the time.
No, I'm sorry. But... They most likely had like Elvis's childhood friend and former,
Red West.
I don't know what his bodyguard, you know, come and run and grab all the guns and hide them away.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was such an odd scene because they're sort of chuckling. They're like, you know, smirking to each other like, I didn't see anything. And it's like, okay, he was a bad guy, but we've just watched a man be murdered. Like, where's the decorum?
You know? What do you mean murdered? I mean, I think they all shot him with shotguns, like blew him over, you know, shot him like five times.
After, and he was a veteran as well, right? He alludes to having been in Korea, you know, like he's just been beaten up by a guy half his age. I felt quite bad for Ben Gazzara.
Well, I don't know, but I think like Brad Wesley, man, he was a pretty strong guy when you got like, you know, all those buckshots blowing holes through him and he still managed to stand.
He's still coming. He's still coming. Yeah, he was pretty tough. He was pretty tough. He was good. I think Ben Gazzara does a good job as the villain, actually. I mean, like it's maybe a little bit beneath him, some of the stuff that he's been in. You know, he did a lot of work with Cassavetes before, but he gets into it. He's, you know, he's probably not breaking a sweat because he's got that kind of shark kind of look to him, but he relishes the role and, you know, he's a real piece of work.
Yeah, well, on set, I guess he was a bit like, depending, I guess, who's telling the story, a bit of a prima donna, a bit of a diva, aloof. Call like, you know, instead of like, you know, people by their names, it would be like hair, makeup. Just, yeah, but I think also it sounded like it was part of the reason why he was method and he was in that Brad Wesley character the whole time he was on set.
Right.
So I think he was treating people a certain way because, yeah, he was method.
I mean, I got to give respect to a guy that's going into Roadhouse and playing it method. You know, like, because he could have just phoned it in, but he's like, right, I got to be more like Brad Wesley. I got to live in a mansion with a river next to it, with an old boy across the river. You know, like, I got to drive my monster truck to work every day and like crush a few car dealerships and really get into it. You know, it works. You know, it's there must be a ton of movies like this where people don't put in half as much effort and they're just junk, right? You know, whereas this is a movie that says, okay, this is ridiculous. We know it's ridiculous, but we're going to throw in these amazing fight scenes. They have, you know, you've got Jeff Healey, who I won't pretend to be particularly familiar with, but he's a real musician playing all the way through the movie, the blind guitarist who's great. You got flipping Tito from Tito and the Tarantulas playing at the start of the movie. So, you know, you've got great music in there. Couple of musicians or musician adjacent people, like you said, Red West, John Doe turns up as a barman in there. He did a couple of movies in the 80s. You know, he was in a band called X. I mean, it's for what it is, and it's definitely like painted in primary colors, but it's written entertainingly, it's acted beyond competently by everyone, really. You know, like, it's well cast. Sam Elliott brings a real nice dose of kind of color to the proceedings, you know, like really chewing the scenery with his kind of gruff cowboy twang, and, you know, like you can always like kind of hear his mustache in his words, like he sounds like he's chewing on it half the time, and, you know, his kind of grisly voice is great. The supporting roles are filled with faces that you recognize, so it's very simple, it's very basic, but it's done really well. And, you know, like, it would be easy to be harsh on this film, and I think it got about 4 Razzie nominations the year it was released, but I think time has been kind of kind to it. You know, as a cult classic, it's kind of, you know, people know that they can take it with a pinch of salt, and I think it was almost one of the first movies where people really embraced that idea of a daft movie being something that you can really get behind and really enjoy.
Well, you're speaking of Healey. I think we were talking about how they use them effectively. One way was to use them, his scenes, as transitions. So, right, but everything that was cut out and was a mess, they would stick him on. So every transition would be him playing. So they used them to great effect. Also, I think another reason why it's so good, I mean, I think because you had Joel Silver as producer, he was very hands-on, and then also this cinematographer as well. And I think he came in who in the cinematographer worked with a lot of great directors, and he wanted to work with new directors. I think it looks good. Yeah. As you said, like well acted. And I think Silver came in with a lot of good ideas, and like, you know, and Tom Cruise, you know, kind of parried him in Tropic Thunder, but like as this over the top producer.
Right.
I think he was that way. And some of his suggestions were really strange and bizarre, but ultimately, you know, I think it fell into the world that they were trying to create. You know, he's coming from a lot of great movies and his experiences, and then he put his stamp on this flick. I think if they wanted to make a great B movie or the best B movie, this is up there with them. It's something that like this movie, as bizarre as it is entertaining. You can't take your eyes off of it. You question a lot of things, but I guess that's part of the charm. And then also these guys were really, you know, beating each other up and really injured. Right. And Patrick Swayze really paid for it. I think like, you know, that final fight like occurred over like 5 nights and you know, sometimes they improvise. He was hit with a log instead of like a fake one. And since he was shirtless, they had to keep putting makeup over his bruises.
Right.
And it was the same for the guy that was playing the villain where, you know, he had to like lie in the water in the night, you know, holding his breath, like as he like floated across this lake. It's, you know, they didn't, I don't know how much money was pumped into this, but whatever little or the amount they had, they used it wisely and well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Silver is, you know, he's got some great, great credits to his name. He knows what he's doing. And yeah, a lot of them, I mean, he was involved in Predator. I'm pretty sure the Lethal Weapon movies, you know, like his movies very much are, you know, these kinds of things. I'm pretty sure Arnold Schwarzenegger is the best at something in the movie Predator, you know, like it's Mel Gibson is the best shot in the Marines or something, or he was before, you know, the events of Lethal Weapon. Like, he's not making subtle movies, but they're very entertaining. I think they're meant to be sketches of, you know, archetypal characters almost. You know, it's almost rolling things right back to kind of classic storytelling. And yeah, you get a good group of people together. You talked about the cinematographer, Dean Cundey. You know, I mean, he worked with Carpenter, Zemeckis, you know, like, he's got some incredible credits on his resume. The music was Michael Kamen, who, again, he did a ton of great things. It's just going to that extra trouble to make sure that everything you've got works. And it's almost kind of antithetical to what a lot of filmmakers would say, which is like, you know, if you don't have a great script, you don't have a movie. And it's almost like, well, if you've got like a great cast and a great producer and a great cinematographer and great music and an okay script, you know, maybe you've still got a pretty entertaining movie. I mean,
also they brought in a good editor to clean it up as well. So
right, you know,
Silver wanted to make the best driving movie ever, and he did. And then you also have the movie being vindicated on cable. So as you said, it got the Razzies, it didn't do well, it was panned, but then it made TBS the superstation, like it. You know, played well on cable. It brought in a lot of viewers, and it's still like, and also it's one of those roles that, you know, Swayze is known for today. So I think, how can I say, I don't know if you would call it like so bad it's good, but it definitely left a mark. And, you know, police forces, you know, quoted, other bouncers quoted, you know, in terms of how you must conduct yourself for better or for worse, you know, in terms of just remaining, you know, keeping calm and cool in the face of volatile situations. So, and now you have this remake, right? So it definitely left its mark.
It did, you know, be nice above all, be nice. Okay. All right. Which is a great quote from this movie, but I've got a little game I've prepared for you, BC. You didn't know about this. This is a big surprise. Okay. But speaking of quotes, all right, I'm going to read you some quotes and I just want you to have a guess of who said them. Okay, you don't need to give me the actor if you can't remember their name, or, but you know, like, just okay. Give me a hint of who the character is. Okay, so quote number one. These are my four favorite quotes from the movie Roadhouse. So number one, you know, I heard you had balls big enough to come in a dump truck, but you don't look like much to me. Who said that, BC? I'll give you bonus points if you can name the actor.
Name the actor. I mean, it was one of the bar staff. I don't know which one, because it's like asshole number one, asshole number two, asshole number three. I don't know. I just know it's one of the bar staff when he first goes to
it is
called the Double Deuce.
In the Double Deuce, yeah. It's I forget the name of the character, but the actor that played him was Terry Funk, who was a WWF wrestler for many years and turned up in a few heavy roles over the years.
Oh, so that's Morgan. Was he the first bouncer, the main bouncer that got kicked out?
Yeah, he said, you don't have the right temperament.
Yeah.
Okay, and also, like, I assume he means balls big enough to come in and fill up a dump truck with cum.
Yes, that's right.
Right, that was my assumption.
No, what? I thought he meant, like, your balls are so big you only can fit in a dump truck.
He says, I heard you had balls big enough to come in a dump truck.
Yeah, like you bringing them in a dump truck. Like your balls come in a dump truck. Not you.
Okay.
Your balls are emptying it out into a dump truck. Dump okay. truck. You know.
That's right. This is okay. This is no longer safe for work, listener. All right. My next quote. This one's short. There's always Barber College. Who said that?
Oh.
Might be the same scene, actually.
Was it Swayze? I don't know who
it was. It was Swayze.
That.
Yeah. No, it was Swayze. When he fires the guy, and the guy's like, what am I supposed to do now? He's like, there's always Barber College.
Well, I liked your mother, that whole, the mother exchange. That was
Yeah. I think it's the same guy. Yeah. Like,
yeah, that's great.
What if some guy calls my mother a cocksucker? Like, well, is she?
Yeah,
All right. One out of two so far, not bad. Next right. one. That gal's got entirely too many brains to have an ass like that.
Oh, that's fucking that's our favorite what was it? Eternally old man Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott. I wish I could do his voice, because that, like, him saying that line, I think I spat my drink out. I just kind of turned to my girlfriend and I was like, they don't write him like that anymore. All right. Okay. Last one. I know you're going to get this. I used to fuck guys like you in prison.
Yeah. I mean, it's that, well, the guy who's fighting at the end of the movie, which is what's, you know, that is, yeah. I still think the, yeah, I guess, yeah. What if they call my mother a cocksucker? Like, that's such a funny, like, exchange. But that...
What if they call my mother a whore? Yeah.
But that line at the end, when they're fighting, when he says that, and it's just like, what? like I don't...
I know, it's like how is that an insult?
yeah, it's just how you're supposed to interpret any of this. Like, yeah. I was processing that for a long time. Like, when he said that, and I was just like, what?
It like, would be great to edit the movie and just have Patrick Swayze stop and just be like, sorry, do you want to talk about some stuff, buddy? Like, it's maybe we should just sit down and have a cup of tea. Like, are you okay? Like, does that mean like you're going to beat me up? Or does that mean like we're going to date? Or like what?
What happens it's next? Such a weird line.
But maybe it's just, I don't know. Well, I read that apparently when the actor who said it, Marshall Teague, went to the theater with his mum and he shouted that line, she like jumped up and started applauding and said, like, that's my boy. So maybe it's a Missouri thing. I don't know. Like, it's.
Well, he's it's something. Well, they didn't get along until that fight, I think. And then they became like lifelong friends, right? Like, there was tension on the set. And I think that fight over the nights bonded them. I'm also, I guess, the ripping of the trachea. That was an idea that came from the The ripping out of the trachea was an idea that came from the cinematographer. Is that correct?
Oh, I don't know.
So from what I understood was like they're, you know, they're filming that fight scene. And then the cinematographer said, oh, when I was in college, guys used to say that, like, you know, they heard a story that during a fight, someone got their trachea ripped out. And then I told the director and then they went for it.
I can believe it because it captures that in a way that only a real kind of campfire story can, you know, like it just feels like the kind of thing that you heard some guy did, you know, like I can imagine when Roadhouse came out, I'm sure before people were really too familiar with it, playgrounds just being full of this story, you know, like, oh, you hear about that guy that got in a fight and ripped someone's throat out, you know, like, before people even realized it had come from a movie. It's just got that kind of feel to it. So I can totally believe that was a rumor. And yeah, Dean Cundey's probably gone to the director and said, here's a solution. I mean, it's very simple, but like we said earlier, like as soon as it's been mentioned once, you know, when he walks into the bar and the guy's like, oh, I hear he ripped some guy's throat out once. You're like, okay, this is fucking on now. Like, we know how far this guy goes. And, you know, at the end when he's about to do it again and he's kind of got like the claw pose over Ben Gazzara and his girlfriend's watching like, please don't rip another person's throat out. Like, just stop at two.
Well, I mean, she's the sane one, right? Like she sees this dude like lose his marbles and like, you know, starts like, you know, like, yeah, ripping out throats and just going on this rampage. And she like was sane enough to like, you know, stay away from him. Like she just hadn't like, you know, she just kind of had enough. She saw that he snapped and she's like going to keep her distance, which kind of makes sense.
Right? Like she doesn't shoot Ben Gazzara.
No, it was the guy from the dealership, Elvis's childhood friend. And then the owner of the bar, but she sees all this.
She watches it. She's okay with them doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say she's okay with it. And she gets back with Dalton.
Yeah, and everything's good. Everything's as it should be. Yeah, because I'm just trying to track back because, yeah, like Sam Elliott gets... They kind of do this weird thing where like Sam Elliott... It's almost like a really crap version of that scene from The Dark Knight. Like Sam Elliott and the girlfriend are both kind of temporarily missing. And Patrick Swayze doesn't know like... where they are, and like I think Ben Gazzara phones up and says you can only save one of them, and I'm like,
this is like the Dark Knight
like 20 years earlier. But
yeah, that's where
Sam Elliott comes back. Yeah, he comes back beaten up, and it's kind of like a double bluff, like he leaves him again, and then when he comes back to the bar he's dead. And there's like a little moment where this blood trickles over a tattoo that says Rose. And I think that was another moment that was cut out of the movie because I think Sam Elliott had like this whole backstory of having a girlfriend that he left, like he got the tattoo. But, you know, I don't know. But like, because there's definitely a few. You're right. It's very well edited because there's lots of holes, but you don't notice them when you're watching it. You know, like there's a few moments, but where it's maybe a little confusing. But like the Keith David thing, if you didn't know who Keith David was, you wouldn't notice that character had been cut out, and you know, like it's never jarring, but
also like, as you said, Carrie Ann disappears, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, and all the rest of the bouncers too, right? Like all that stuff kind of, the whole bar goes away because like the wanton violence has spilled onto the streets. Like, you know, like, so yeah.
Like, what happens?
There's no
in
resolution.
America.
You don't know what happens to those people in the bar.
If you rip a guy's throat out in America and you just throw him in a river, if you were protecting your girlfriend's honor or something, like that's okay. Like there's no repercussions for that kind of thing. Or is that a state thing? Is that Missouri?
Yeah, it's Missouri, I think. I don't know. Like listen to these bouncers talk. Like if they were talking about America, like, yeah, it's like, you know, being sued and you're not like, you know, now like people don't really have fights in clubs anymore because people bring guns, and it's all about keeping the guns out of the clubs, and then they'll save it for outside, and they'll just like, you know, it's you know, that's kind of what happens. Unless you're like in smaller towns, depending on, you know, who the customers are and like if the bouncers have real, like, a lot of power. They'll take the phones and, you know, delete, like, you know, whatever it's called on video. But they're saying, American towns where you have guys like the Wesley character. They said they experienced that, like, guys who think they're big men who, for whatever reason, have power and will do, you know, some of the things you see in the movie. I don't know about, you know, to what extent. But then you might have, like, you know, like the guys challenging you, you know. And then also they said that the whole thing with kicking someone in the leg works, but, like, you know, you won't break a knee, but they'll bring someone down, like putting pressure on a leg. But they said the roundhouse kick stuff doesn't work. You wind up getting hurt yourself. You know, so, like, that stuff doesn't work. One bouncer preferred to use his leg. The other one preferred, like, you know, pummel people. But ultimately, it's trying to avoid the fights and just keep people out. So at all costs, like, out of the bars and, you know, squelching things and keeping the guns out. But it just sounds like all the different things you've seen in this movie happens.
Yeah.
And then if you're outside of America, like, for example, if you're in Europe where there are no guns, then you got more fights in the bars.
For sure. Yeah. Have you ever been in a barroom brawl?
No.
I've been in one.
What?
And it's. I mean, what? I wasn't the perpetrator, believe it or not. It was in a pub that I used to drink in regularly. And I think my friend had, like, booked it for his birthday party or something. So we were all in there, and we were all in, like, I guess we were like in a, we were maybe 20. We're all wearing, like, suits, you know, looking ridiculous, like we've borrowed our dad's suits or something. And these young guys came in, and they weren't, like, maybe one of them was, like, tangentially invited, and a couple of others followed them in, and we're kind of like, who the hell are these guys? Like, we don't really know them. We weren't really giving them much attention, but they kind of crept in, and I think there was a bit of talk, like, oh, you know, it's kind of a closed bar tonight, guys. And but they'd kind of taken almost like tactical positions throughout the bar, and there was this big barman. He was a really nice guy, but he, you know, he was pretty hefty, and he was getting a bit of grief off of one of them. He asked him to leave. And then out of nowhere, another one, like, kind of leapt over the bar and smashed a glass on his head. And then, like, I remember just, like, freezing, and there was, like, glasses flying by, and then all the barmen are jumping over the bar. And, like, a couple of my more pugilistic friends started, like, kind of wading into it. And, like, eventually they got all these guys out. I mean, they were only, like, they weren't older guys, they were, like, you know, a bunch of teenagers that just kind of infiltrated. And yeah, but there was, like, a couple of smashed chairs and, like, glasses, and I was like, shit, like, this isn't as fun as it looks in Hollywood. Like, I kind of froze, like, I don't want to get any glass on me, you know, like, it was but it's you see that kind of shit in the UK, like, yeah, like, I, that's the biggest thing I've ever seen. But I've definitely seen plenty of fights kick off in pubs and things like that, because people don't really carry weapons and things around with them traditionally, or at least they didn't when I was still regularly in pubs. Who knows what they do now? But yeah, it's not an experience I would recommend. I don't have fond memories of it.
No, like, yeah, it's it's it sounds like it's about the gunplay now, not so much at least in the States, but it could be crazy in other places, like, I'm sure, like, Mexico or where have you, like, you know, just can't imagine. But they said there's places where you'll have, like, guys who are running towns just like this. And also it sounds like cops are in trouble as well, because cops want to go into bars bringing their guns, and then they're stopped and they're drunk and want to bring in their guns, and that's a whole, it sounds like another whole, like, type of ordeal. So yeah, just keep them out.
It's a powder keg.
Truce. Yeah. But yeah, it sounds outside of America too. If, like, you know, people, like, who have, like, bouncers and guards, like, they need to make sure their bouncers, the like famous persons or well-off persons security, they can't come in with the gun. So then they'll get assigned their own kind of bouncers for protection, like the club's bouncer will protect these VIPs again, just to keep the guns out. But then whatever happens outside is like something else. They really have cars that, you know, sometimes cars are broken into depending where they're parked around the facility. Nothing's personal, but I guess sometimes on occasions, like you'll have like pissed off customers will go after the person or their family, like outside the place. But it sounds like that's a rarity.
Yeah, it's not a career. I mean, like I briefly considered joining the Air Force after watching Top Gun. Watching Roadhouse does not make me want to be a bouncer. So it's definitely not a recruitment video.
I think, again, it depends where you are. Like, if I was a bouncer in Japan, sure. Yeah. Being a bouncer in America, I mean, no.
You're just like a cop without a badge, you know? Like, I mean, surrounded by drunk people who...
Yeah,
like, that is a way that a lot of people go when they're drunk, is towards violence and towards challenging, you know, authority figures. Even just being a bar person is, I'm sure, bad enough, you know. But like, if you're the bouncer, people are going to look at you and say, well, you obviously think you're pretty tough. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, we had kind of the bouncer mafia almost in the town I grew up in. Like, all the bouncers and all the bars kind of knew each other, and quite often if something was going on in one bar, you'd see bouncers come from other bars to kind of join in on, you know, kicking someone's head in, as we would call it.
Jeez.
In the UK, which, yeah, they were a nasty bunch. So you just kind of, you didn't give them any trouble at all. You know, the places that had bouncers, you stayed well clear of, because yeah, you didn't know what might happen. If you did go in, you know, you certainly behaved, because they were often just nasty, you know.
Well, it also sounds like if the place is popular as well, like, you know, you got lines out the door, like, so as a bouncer, you're probably looking for any incentive to get people out, to get that money and bring those people lined up in. So,
yeah, that's true.
If you wanted to stay, you would probably be on your best behavior too. Not to get kicked out,
for sure.
But yeah, sure. Like now, like if someone touches you now, like I'm sure you would just sue the establishment. Like you can't, like yeah, you can't be putting your hands on people or kicking their faces in. But
you ever been bounced?
No, I haven't been bounced. No,
I've been bounced once. I like the fact that I'm like, yeah, I've been in brawls, I've been bounced. I'm like the biggest wimp, like the first sign of violence, and like I am immediately in like fight flight mode and out of there. But I think I was in like a metal club, and I was, you know, moshing, as it's called, and I somehow like got my hand around some guy's like neck while I was doing it, and I think I sort of like, I mean, I don't think I actually flipped him over, but I kind of like dragged him a bit, and it looked aggressive. And the bouncers were on me straight away. And I mean, I didn't put any fight up. I put my hands on top of my head like I was being arrested and just kept shouting at everyone like, I'm being thrown out because I'm too violent. Look at me. I'm too violent, like that. Because, you know, listeners who haven't seen me, I'm you know, 5'6" with a strong southerly breeze and not very muscular. So I'm not an imposing figure.
No, I mean, I think you're kind of like Patrick Swayze, you know.
Yeah, I'm shorter than you expect.
Yeah, there you go. How apropos.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, you know, everyone should have at least one barroom brawl and get thrown out of one bar. What? Just for the life experience. It's you know.
Sure. Sure.
Okay, don't do that then, but watch Roadhouse if you haven't. Make sure you take it with a pinch of salt, a shot of tequila, and a slice of lemon.
Yeah, you'll need that.
Yeah, and yeah,
this movie.
Absolutely. Well, do you have anything more to add from the vault?
Just, you know, while you watch the movie, like listen out for, you know, Swayze singing. Other than that, no, I think it's, I guess it's something you can watch once, Yeah. You know, you might not get that time back, but it's actually much better than I imagined. I mean, it's a 2 hour run. So what they knocked off an hour for you, but, no, I think it's for what it is. I don't think it's as bad as, I imagine. Like, I was really dreading watching this movie. I was like, I can't believe I got to watch Roadhouse. Just can't believe I got to sit and watch this mess. And then as soon as it started, I was just like, what is this? But no, as it went on, like, no, no, it has its moments. It's enjoyable. I think the biggest thing is, like, yeah, probably like the fights and the action, and then to know, like, afterwards, like, oh, these people were really doing this, like falling out of windows and jumping over, like, you know, like, I don't even know what you would call them, like, these like indoor porches, for lack of a better word. And like, it's crazy. It's crazy. So I think it's worth watching. And then if you never watch it again, you know, I don't blame you, but I think it is something to go back and watch at least once.
Yeah. And so Jake Gyllenhaal and Doug Liman have got some relatively reasonable sized boots to fill, I think.
I think they're also, there's talk of it supposedly becoming a franchise. We'll see how that goes.
Wow. Well, with Ryan Gosling doing The Fall Guy and Jake Gyllenhaal doing Roadhouse, I mean, I don't know what's next. Sort of, you know, respectable actors reigniting bizarre franchises from the 1980s.
Yeah.
Maybe
like
we'll
the Rockford
see
Files or something.
Yeah, like
or Barney
Mark Ruffalo,
Miller,
TJ Hooker, or.
I'm surprised that didn't. I'm sure that's next. That it sounds so plausible.
Yeah, it's got such a memorable title. Okay, well, I had a lot of fun watching Roadhouse and talking about it. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Dr. Welp. I always use staples, not stitches. And you can find me on TikTok and Instagram. And you are.
BC Noir. I did not spend a month in the hospital learning how to give stitches and only to use staples. So, mind you, you don't need any medical training to watch this movie.
He's the best podcaster in the world, and I'm the second best. and in a fight, no one wins. And if you see a dump truck, come in it. Good night.